From KCRW in Santa Monica, I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner, and this is The Business.
So you still want to do the show business, and you think that you got what it takes? I mean, you really got to rap and be all that, but prepare yourself for the breaks. Check it out.
This week on The Business, Hollywood's been beguiled and bedeviled by Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged ever since it was published in 1957. 50 years later, why hasn't it been made into a movie? We talked to legendary producer Al Ruddy, the first guy to get Rand's go-ahead. That was back in 1974. But first, it's the Hollywood News Caravan. Go nowhere, it's The Business from NPR. Last week, TiVo and satellite provider DirecTV announced they're getting remarried. Only this time, it's a shotgun wedding. They'll be partnering on a new high-definition DVR in a move that will save DirecTV from costly copyright litigation and save TiVo from possible ruin. You see, way back in 2006, DirecTV dumped TiVo to create its own line of digital recorders on the cheap. The move cost TiVo millions of customers, but it was about to cost DirecTV some serious legal fees. In fact, DirecTV's closest competitor, Dish Network, is bracing to pay $130 million in potential fines because it copied TiVo's technology and wouldn't stop using it. The judge in the case may also rule that Dish won't be able to offer its current TiVo clone DVRs to its 4 million customers. Part of TiVo's new deal with DirecTV is that they won't sue for similar infringements. Speaking of thievery, Michael Moore has pirates walking the plank. His new film will be available for 3 weeks as a free download to North American residents, beginning on September 23rd. Entitled Slacker Uprising, it follows his 62-city voter registration tour during the 2004 election. Moore's last documentary, The Healthcare Indictment Sicko, grossed a respectable $24 million in theaters domestically, but it was also heavily pirated before its release, which probably hurt its numbers. There's more foreboding numbers in music news, this time for the sales of entire albums. Warner Brothers Records recently blocked U.S. fans of English R&B singer Estelle from cherry-picking singles off her new album Shine, and the results have been rather dull. After being removed from the U.S. iTunes store as a single, Estelle's American Boy dropped from the iTunes top 10 to number 37, and from number 6 to number 59 on the official Billboard downloads chart. Finally, we say goodbye to voiceover giant Don LaFontaine, who died last week. LaFontaine recorded more than 5,000 movie trailers over 33 years and, of course, popularized the catchphrase, "In a world." He got his first gig in 1965 when an announcer didn't show up to do the trailer voiceover for MGM's Gunfighters of Casa Grande. Last Monday, Don rode off into the sunset. He was 68. And that's the Hollywood News Caravan. Coming up next, Hollywood asks, who is John Galt? No, really, like, does he work at ICM? Hollywood has been trying to make a movie out of Ayn Rand's controversial epic novel Atlas Shrugged since it came out in 1957. Even with giant stars like Angelina Jolie rumored to be attached, there is still no movie of Atlas Shrugged. Now, it's not even a little bit unusual for a film project to take years and years and years to make it to the screen. But even by Hollywood's tortured standards, Atlas Shrugged has been through all 9 circles of development hell. Its road to the big screen is a tale as immense as the 1,200-page book itself. You see, the task of converting such a tome into a screenplay would have been tough enough. But the book was more than the story of a woman who ran a railroad and a man who would cleanse America of its looters by destroying it. In the book, the Russian-born Rand outlined a dogmatic, conservative philosophy that would later be known as objectivism. And the Templars of that faith have guarded the book carefully since her death in 1982. Today, we're talking with Al Ruddy, the first producer to get the rights to Atlas Shrugged from the author Ayn Rand. He won Best Picture Oscars as producer of The Godfather and Million Dollar Baby. Both movies, we should point out, adaptations from novels.
Look, like everybody else, Atlas Shrugged was one of those great, probably the greatest American epic novel that had never been put to film. And it was always one of those things that every producer, director, actor wanted to do.
Okay? Right.
But it was one of those legends, you know, Fred Zinnemann, everyone wanted to do Atlas Shrugged. So,
and we should point out, you're at like the peak of success at this point. You just produced The Godfather.
Oh, absolutely.
Which was runaway. No,
that's
massive,
how I happened to get an appointment with her. I created Hogan's Heroes, had some other minor successes, but The Godfather was the big one. So I called up Hines agent, Curtis Brown, and he said, "Al, out of respect for The Godfather and you, she'd be happy to meet you, but I can tell you, she is not going to give the book to anybody. I can tell you off the record." I said, "Just get me in a room with her. That's all. Get me in a room with her." About a week later, he gives me a call. "Can you come up to the office, Curtis Brown and Madison Avenue?" Now, the one thing I knew, and it's the theme of the book that I found the most fascinating, Ayn Rand was a very sexual woman. You look at the founder, everything she ever did, but in Atlas Shrugged especially, the Dagny Taggart character has a love affair with the three greatest guys that ever walked. I mean, she was a lusty, sexy broad, okay? Now, I walk into the meeting at Curtis Brown. It's a half a floor. The office is huge. There are about 15 different chairs. Her agent's got a big desk behind Ms. Madison Avenue. And sitting in front of the desk in a small love seat is this diminutive woman. I walked in, and I looked at this love seat, and I figured, I'm going to move in on her. And I squeezed into this love seat, and I put my arms around her. We could hardly move. She looked up at me. She was, I think Ayn was about 5'2". She looked up at me. She said, "Darling, what books do you read?" I said, "Ayn, I don't read many novels, but I've read yours twice." She had a smile on her face, right? And we start hitting it up. It was a marvelous conversation. I said, "Let's be very candid, Ayn. I want to declare what I'm interested in. I am not interested in your philosophy. I'm not an objectivist. I can't be one of your acolytes." She said, "Darling, I never wrote Atlas Shrugged. The objectivist movement came after Atlas Shrugged, not before." I said, "I'm interested in your book because I find it very theatrical and very sexy. It's a unique concept, and that hooks me." She said, "Darling, that's exactly what I think the book's about." Now I become the first person she's agreed to give the book to. We have a big party at 21. It's in all the papers. We're lovey-dovey, right?
Now, when you say give the book to, we should be clear. She's giving you the rights to make this movie.
Excuse me, the rights to make the movie.
And there's been a cavalcade of producers sort of knocking at the door with candy and flowers.
No one ever got it. Everyone in America went.
Why do you think she responded to your entreaties?
First of all, I hit her in the one area that I think no one had the balls to do. I said, "Ayn, it's a sexy, hot novel with a great woman, the greatest female part." I still believe that. One of the greatest parts for a woman ever written. So
you go to 21, big party.
We have big party at 21. We are moving ahead, lovey-dovey. We have lawyers working the contract down. Then inevitably, we hit the stumbling block. And that was, she insisted on having final script approval. Without being adamant initially, I try to explain to her the problems that a producer has in trying to get a movie made. If you can't deal with the director, you can't do the script we want to do because we have to give it to you to get it approved, which is insane. You know,
we're trying to adapt a book
that's over 1,000 pages, right? So what are we doing? We have to take the essence of this massive novel, 1,000 pages, and get it onto at least 190 page screenplay. That means there's 80% of it may not come in. So you got to say philosophically, what is this book about? What is it about? I mean, the marvelous thing, the fun about it, if you read Atlas Shrugged. The thing about her is, if you didn't get what she said on page 25, you get it again on page 45, 85, 105, 200. She beats you to death philosophically with the point she's trying to make. But I try to say, look, I can't get into the process, Ayn, if you have final script approval. To be very candid, John Galt says goodbye to America for about 60 pages, the end of the book. You want to do that on film? In the contract, before we got to the point that she wanted script approval, she has put certain caveats in. One of them was she had to fly in a private jet from New York to Los Angeles whenever we needed her for meetings. I said, why? She said, darling, if the Russians find out what flight I'm on, they'll hijack the plane. Oh, I said, really? Now, it got a little extreme. By the end, when I assured her, I said, I would protect this book. I'm telling you what I want to do with it. That's the movie I'm going to make. And she said, darling, it's not that I don't trust you. The Russians will buy Paramount Studios to destroy it. I said, all right, trust me. I know the Russians may not like your book, but they're not dumb enough to buy Paramount Pictures to try to get it. So we hit this insoluble man, and we couldn't get over it. And I said, you know, I was in New York, and I figured I'd make one more pass at this thing, right?
And this is now how far along? This is now
19? This is probably 1 month after 21. So I was with my secretary, Betty McCart, in New York. Now, her cat had died. So I said, she was living on 34th Street with her husband, Frank, who was a little senile at that point. Frank O'Connor, working with white gloves in the house. I said, let's get Ina, a little kitten. We'll go up to the house, give her the kitten, we'll melt her emotion, and she'll give me the book. Now, in those days, there were flights to Los Angeles every hour. So there was a flight at 6 o'clock, a flight at 7 o'clock. Everyone was flying to Los Angeles. So I come up to the house with Betty, and I give her the cat, which she loved. And we all sat around lovey-dovey, and she was still fighting me. And totally intractable on obviating that one point, which is both of us. I mean, I was not going to give in. She was not going to give in. I couldn't give in because it was impractical to proceed on the project that way. So finally, the last flight was leaving. I swear to God, I was there for 2.5-3 hours. And the last flight was leaving for California. So I said, can I talk to you by myself in the other room? So Ayn gets up. We leave Betty and Frank in the living room. And by this point, I figured I might as well hit her hard because she wants to be, that's how she likes to deal. It's okay with me. I said, I'll tell you my position very simply. If you don't agree to give me what I need to get the movie made, I'm walking out of here and I will wait till you drop dead to get the rights free and clear. She said, darling, the one person I put in my will who can't get the book is you. I said, I'm a producer. I'll have someone else get it. I mean, it became that when I left. She wasn't going to move, and I wasn't dumb enough to buy into that. Okay, Ayn, you and I will make this movie together. That wasn't going to happen, right?
Was there acrimony? Did you leave with a slammed door? Or
when I left, it was not friendly. I think down deep she was afraid to let go of the one thing she had that everyone paid homage to her for.
It's a little-known fact that Ayn Rand came to the States from Russia in 1926 with the idea of actually becoming a screenwriter. She worked briefly for Cecil B. DeMille and wrote a few films, including the adaptation of her own novel, The Fountainhead, with Gary Cooper and Patricia Neal starring. But when legendary director King Vidor tried to edit the endless final soliloquy she wrote for The Fountainhead, Rand complained to the studio and won. The scene goes on for nearly 6 minutes, and it's one of film's longest speeches ever.
Thousands of years ago, the first man discovered how to make fire. He was probably burned at the stake he had taught his brothers to light, but he left them a gift they had not conceived, and he lifted darkness off the earth. Throughout the centuries, there were men who took first steps down new roads, armed with nothing but their own vision. The great creators, the thinkers, the artists, the scientists, the inventors, stood alone against the men of their time. Every new thought was opposed. Every new invention was denounced.
It's anyone's guess as to whether that experience also played a role in her reluctance to give up creative control of Atlas Shrugged, but it probably didn't help. If you're just joining us, we're talking with Al Ruddy about trying to turn Rand's epic novel into a film. Back in 1974, he was the first producer to get the rights to the book, 17 years after it was published.
Over the years, I was approached by other people in the Objectivist, the Ayn Rand circles, because they knew, and this is true, said I was the only person she had ever met up to that point that she knew I could do the movie she wanted to do. I knew how to do that movie. You know what? I had a cast. I was going to do it with Clint Eastwood for Hank Reardon, Bob Redford for John Galt. I was down the road to making this a major. I mean, you want to talk about theatrical scenes? Give me a break. When She goes to the house when Hank has made the bracelet for the wife, the new alloy, at the big party and at the wedding anniversary. And the wife says, this is what I get from my husband. And Dagny Taggart's there, and she says, I'll trade you a diamond bracelet for that. And she takes her diamond bracelet off and takes the alloy, puts it on her wrist. It's great stuff. It's a great love story.
So you walk out of this apartment, and this project is now at least mothballed, maybe deep-sixed.
Well, what I did at the end.
What happens next?
Well, I was approached surreptitiously. I would go to parties, and I realized I was there with the objectivist groups in Bel Air, all wealthy people. They tried to get me re-involved in the project, but by then it was controlled by other people who had their own agenda, and they were playing their own games. And I didn't want to do that. The only way I was interested in doing Atlas Shrugged is if I got the rights to do it free and clear. There were a lot of people who were involved who had to be mollified to acquire the rights. There were severe conditions on the book. When I got re-involved again, it was almost the same thing.
So hold on, let's get a full measure of this. So 1974, you walk out of this apartment, the door slams, and then a whole litany of other producers comes and goes. They'll do it, this, that, the other thing. How do you get back involved? Does she call you?
No. I had calls from certain people on a social circuit in Bel Air and Beverly Hills and Brentwood who were part of the objectivist movement. They were all over the place, right? There were always other people that owned it and other conditions that the people who owned it were under as to how it had to proceed with either the East Coast group of the objectivist movement or the West Coast. There's different groups. And I think there's intestine battle between them all the time. And so the purity of their vision of the objectivist movement with the libertarians, it's a whole other world, trust me. A world I not only don't know that much about, but I frankly didn't want to get involved in because that's, I have other things to do with my life.
It's like trying to make a movie with the Church of Scientology on board.
Yeah, so I drifted around the rims of it. I never jumped in again until this woman calls me up, Gloria. She represents a gentleman named John Aglioro, New Jersey, very wealthy, has the rights to the book.
How does he wind up with these rights?
There were certain constraints. Again, when he got the rights, he paid a substantial amount of money, and then they gave him what I call a narrow window. He had a certain number of years to get it made with the approval of Leonard Piakov down at Sin. There were always people you had to go to who were the guardians, and I think Leonard was the guy you had to have his approval with the treatment of what you wanted to do in the book.
This sounds freaky, like some sort of eyes wide shut secret society of rich, shadowy libertarians.
Believe you me, it makes the Mormons look like an open society. It is. It's a very powerful group. These are extremely wealthy people.
Leonard Peikoff was one of Ayn Rand's acolytes and now controls her estate. He granted various rights to Atlas Shrugged to a procession of producers in the years after Rand's death in 1982, including, according to rumors, Angelina Jolie. Even with her star power, no movie. Coming up after a short break, more with producer Al Ruddy about trying to get Atlas Shrugged off the page and onto the screen. You're listening to The Business from NPR. This is The Business, and I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. Riding high on the success of The Godfather back in 1974, producer Al Ruddy managed to sweet-talk Ayn Rand into giving him the rights to her epic 1,200-page novel-slash-philosophical treatise, Atlas Shrugged, 17 years after it was published. 3 decades and a procession of producers later, he's been occasionally re-involved by the new owners, including a recent stab at it by producer Howard Baldwin. Baldwin developed the Narnia books for the screen and also produced the biopic, Ray.
Well, he had gotten the rights to Atlas Shrugged, and what he had done, because they came to me to see if I was interested in getting involved in it again, and what he had done is he gave me a screenplay that was half the book. In other words, it ended with the train going over the trestle with the two of them on it. Then he was going to do another movie behind that. I thought that was a noble thought, but I thought impractical. I said, you can't do Atlas Shrugged Part 1 and have people come back a year later for Part 2. It doesn't work that way. But what the basic thing that happened to me and was the my conclusion why I walked away from it, I said, oh, really, this would be a great idea. We're going to do a movie that, to make the point philosophically that Ayn Rand is trying to make, they have to blow America apart. That's the point. Atlas Shrugged is, we're taking the whole system down to start over again. Well, that was fine when she wrote the book. I said to myself, wait a second. Do I believe that America wants to watch? And this is the nub of the book. This is how she makes her philosophical points, quite simple. Not that it has no resonance today. It's just her methodology is a little obsolete at the moment. The end of Atlas Shrugged in the book, remember, is every light in America goes out. And at the end, there's one light on. The whole system has collapsed. It's going to start again. Do I believe people want to sit there and watch them go? They're terrified. They're going to blow their bridge up they're driving home on, you know, with the Homeland Security thing. You go to the airport today, who wants to fly anymore? It takes you an hour to get through security to get on a plane.
So your advice to the new producers is don't make it.
Well, you know, I've thought about that. And my advice to the new producers is I would hone in very strongly on the love story and try to minimize what I don't want to go into how I proceeded and how I think I got it down into a script at the end, because I made some changes that I thought got them where I wanted to go in a solution that was different from the mechanics of the book, but not philosophically what the book was driving towards. But you have to wrestle with it, you know? Again, it comes down to, what do you think Atlas Shrugged is about? When you know what it's about, when you know what it's about for yourself, you know how to get there. And that was when I did start on The Godfather with Mario. I remember meeting Mario in New York at the St. Regis for lunch. There was a prejudice towards ever hiring the screenwriter or the novelist to do the screenplay. They figured he could never let go of anything. But I said, I want to meet him. So I meet him for lunch. He shows up with the book. And I said, Mario, there's, I'm going to have a fight with the guys on the West Coast. They don't want to hire the novelist because he can't let go of it. He takes the book and throws it across the floor at the restaurant. He said, Al, I'll never open that book again, I swear to God. I said, okay, let's get to work then, see what the movie's about.
So, I mean, without getting into the magic of what Al Ruddy does to scripts or to books, the new producer is Angelina Jolie. Your advice would be what, in a sentence?
I'm the last person to give anyone advice, especially on something like Atlas Shrugged. I respect anyone who loves the book because I love it. I respect the energy that's going to be required and the dedication to make a great movie. But there are certain choices that are critical to be made. And remember, this is one of the dangers of doing this book. For the millions of people that have read Atlas Shrugged, they're going to say, well, what happened to the scene with the bracelet? It's gone. I mean, people read this like the Bible. So, I'm a great fan of Angelina Jolie.
So the advice seems to be, don't be afraid to do whatever you need to.
You're going to have to change things, and you're going to have to lose things. The only thing, what is it about? Why do you want to do this movie? You got to keep asking yourself that. What do you want to do this movie for? Well, we all want to do it because we think it's an important piece. Now, I got suckered in that way, too. You don't find many things of that quality. And look, it's a very theatrical piece. Okay, we all know why you may undertake it, but what is it about? Why do you really want to make it? Because once you say, I'm going to make it, now you really got to say, okay, why? What is it about? This is nothing you can tinker with like doing an action piece, you know. This isn't doing a Laura Tomb Raider, you know. This is different. And I'm sure they understand that. I know that Angelina Jolie has always been in love with this book. I think she's smart. Don't misunderstand me. I've always said Dagny Tackett is the greatest part ever written for any woman in any piece of literature I have ever read, bar none. So I can understand her fascination with it. And who knows? She can make one of the greatest movies ever done. I haven't talked to her. No one's consulting me on my ideas, nor am I interested in passing my ideas along, frankly, because I know that had I done it the way I wanted to do it, I would have, I believe, kept the integrity of the book, been able to say, this is what Atlas Shrugged is about, but I would have people jumping all over me.
What strikes me about that is that you need a sort of ridiculous amount of passion to get a movie like that made at all. And there's almost should be an award just for getting the project made. But unfortunately, there isn't.
Oh, I've always said that.
So my question is, can you have too much passion?
Oh, you could, but I've always said they should give an award. I always say this. The Academy Award, they should give an award to a guy that got the most unlikely movie made. You know, it takes a lot of gall and balls to get something done against all odds with everyone telling you you're mad. What are you doing this for? So I respect that. Look, getting any movie made today is extremely difficult. I have friends who run studios. I won't embarrass them by quoting by their names, but they tell me, Al, I don't green light a movie by myself anymore. We have a video and foreign and digital. We sit in a room. No one person say, I'll put my career on the line. Let's make this movie. Are you kidding me? Those days are over. When you have your average distribution cost, average, $30, $40 million, that doesn't get you anywhere, you know? So it's a collective. What goes on in studios today is not, it was much easier when Paramount was just Bob Evans and Peter Bart and Charlie Bludorn. Now it's multinational and it's bloomed up and there's so many, you know.
But the question I'm interested in getting your thought on is, with some of these movies, they get made, but they shouldn't have been made.
Oh, no question about it.
Can passion cloud your judgment?
Well, there is nobody that ever came through this town, as you know, who made the right decision on everything they did. I wish every movie I did was a great success. I mean, I love them. I did a movie with Lee Marvin and Charlie Bronson called Death Hunt that I love, but it wasn't successful. Not everything you do. And I understand that is going to become a raving big success.
Al Ruddy is the producer of movies like The Godfather, my favorite, Million Dollar Baby, and, of course, at one point, the producer of Atlas Shrugged.
We're all going to be curious to see what happens in the next couple of years with Atlas Shrugged.
Well, we'll keep an eye on it. Al Ruddy, thanks for being on The Business.
Thanks again, guys, for coming by.
And that's The Business. Matt Holzman produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. Our associate producer is Darby Maloney. Welcome back, Darby. You can listen to this or any past program online anytime at kcrw.com/thebusiness. You can podcast the show, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog with the click of a button from our new media player at kcrw.com, and you can podcast the show through iTunes. Our email address is thebusiness@kcrw.org. The Business is produced by KCRW Santa Monica and distributed by National Public Radio. I'm Claude Rodester-Ackner. We'll see you next week on The Business.